In November 1986, Toshio Suzuki found himself in a tight spot at the Shinchosha Publishing Office in Japan. Known for attracting Japan's finest authors, Shinchosha was a giant in the world of book publishing. A crucial meeting was on the horizon, poised to conclude swiftly with smiles all around, leaving everyone content.
Everyone, that is, except for Suzuki. He was acutely aware of the enormous risk he would take. The stakes were high, and he understood that failure was not an option. Because if they failed, it would mean the end of Studio Ghibli. Suzuki took a deep breath, adjusting his tie as he stepped into the Shinchosha office. A gentleman, probably in his 50s, with a serious demeanor, sat behind a vast mahogany desk. He was a top executive at Shinchosha Publishing.
Suzuki-san, let's be straightforward. We're not being altruistic here. We're interested in your film, Grave of the Fireflies, because our book is at its core.
Suzuki nodded, trying to gauge the man.
I understand that. The truth is, the story speaks volumes, and I believe it can resonate with many. Given the subject matter, there's a good chance it might even become a mandatory school film. After all, it's about the tragedy of World War II.
Shinchosha was happy. It's exactly what they hoped for.
You have a point. I've seen your previous works, and while I've had my reservations, I must admit, Studio Ghibli has a way of delivering the essence of a story in a unique manner. Far better than most.
You are too kind. We simply work hard. So, shall we see if Studio Ghibli can give Graves of the Fireflies the attention it deserves?
Yeah, I think we can.
Just to let you know, we're considering pairing this film with another one.
And there it was, the big gamble laid out on the table.
What I mean to say is, while we do have another sponsor in Tokoma Shoten to support us, we believe that we can boost overall ticket sales by releasing a dual movie special. This strategy will ensure that fans of both films will get to know about each other's movies.
If it raises ticket sales, I don't see why not.
As the meeting wrapped up and the executives prepared to leave, Suzuki felt his palms begin to sweat. His goal had always been to release the second movie, the one Tokuma Shoten had initially turned down. They'd only reconsidered when he pitched this complicated double feature idea. Deep down, however, Suzuki had a strong feeling in his gut that this plan was going to be a huge success, like nothing anyone had seen before. Just as he was gathering his thoughts, an executive's voice pulled him back.
Suzuki-san?
Yes?
What's the name of this second film?
It's called My Neighbor Totoro.
From 1UP Media, this is Empires, episode 4 of a 5-part series, Before Spirited. My Neighbor Totoro stands as Studio Ghibli's most iconic film. In fact, all subsequent Studio Ghibli films feature the charming furry creature in their introductory logo.
However, This film's existence was nearly compromised due to its drastic departure from Studio Ghibli's established style at the time. In March 1984, after the debut of their first movie, Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, the studio followed up with Castle in the Sky, both of which garnered resounding success. These films, both inhabited worlds, blended with sci-fi and fantasy elements. This led Tokuma Shoten and many publishers to believe that the studio should persist in releasing films of the same genre.
Contrastingly, My Neighbor Totoro presented a stark difference, being set in the post-World War II era and revolving around the lives of two young girls. The story was immediately rejected. To ensure the project's success, Suzuki paired the film with Grave of the Fireflies, a grounded adaptation of a literary work, which were typically approved during that time.
This ingenious strategy not only saved Studio Ghibli, but also enabled them to simultaneously produce their third and fourth movies. However, this approach thrust the company into a completely different set of challenges.
You see, producing one movie is already an immensely challenging journey. Now, the studio found themselves in the position of having to create two films within a span of just 2 years.
Studio Ghibli's journey had truly begun, and the road ahead promised to be rapid and fraught with difficulties.
By the 1st of April 1987, the studio had divided in two, with resources shared between both projects. Grave of the Fireflies for Isao Takahata
and My Neighbor Totoro for Hayao Miyazaki.
Takahata's team was filled with experienced members,
while Miyazaki's was largely newcomers. But as the team settled, a nagging worry grew. With this new direction, moving away from their sci-fi and fantasy roots, how could Studio Ghibli ensure that their animation still resonated as authentic and real?
For Grave of the Fireflies, the answer lay painfully within. This touching film narrates the struggles of two siblings striving to endure the harsh aftermath of the catastrophic firebombings. Isao Takahata, the director of the film, had himself survived these brutal attacks. Likely with hands trembling, he delved into memories he might have wished remained buried. It's the summer of 1945, and the coastal city of Okayama was about to turn into a fiery inferno. Most wouldn't be aware, least of all two children, a young Isao Takahata and his sister, who were walking back home. As the siblings strolled, the tranquility was shattered by the unmistakable roars of planes cutting through the sky. Panic rippled through the boy's spine. They were not prepared for the imminent danger. A bomb's ear-splitting blast echoed. A fragment struck Takahata's sister, rendering her unconscious. In that moment of horrifying realization, panic surged through Takahata. He had to do something fast.
Comes under devastating attack right on the threshold of the capital of Japan. An enemy fighter is blown up.
With adrenaline coursing through his veins, he hoisted his sister into his arms amidst the growing inferno and ran straight towards the river. Buildings, now skeletal and ablaze, painted the skies with an apocalyptic brilliance. With every step towards the river, the terrifying symphony of war raged. The incessant bombings, the consuming fires.
In the river, Takahata found a brief sanctuary, the cool waters battling the scorching heat. There he stood, surrounded by countless others, head down and praying. As silence finally claimed the smoldering city, and the warplanes receded into the haunted night, Takahata realized the relentless onslaught was over, and yet nobody was moving.
For fear of another raid, many, including Takahata and his sister, stay there shivering through the night, only to wake up to a thunderous storm. Formed by the choking soot in the air, black rain began pouring down, coating the dead and the burnt rubble with ash.
Takahata would be one of the few who survived with his family. In the future, he would learn that some 100,000 incendiary bombs lit up the town. This experience would curse Takahata with horrific memories of the war. By the time Grave of the Fireflies was produced, every detail was meticulously crafted, such as the harrowing way bombs exploded, and even the precise direction planes took across the sky.
Such was the film's authenticity and impact that upon release, it became a recommended watch for students. Even now, many Japanese adults remember the film's weight, describing their experience as traumatic. While Isao Takahata channeled his personal pain into creating strikingly realistic scenes for Grave of the Fireflies, Hayao Miyazaki revisited his own past wounds for My Neighbor Totoro.
In the film, the main character, Satsuki, steps into a maternal role for her family when their real mother is hospitalized. In the initial screenplay draft, Suzuki observed that Satsuki's character was portrayed as flawlessly performing her maternal duties, which he found unrealistic. This observation led to a private meeting between Hayao Miyazaki and Suzuki to address the issue.
This is a little unrealistic, isn't it? I don't think there's any child as perfect as this.
Suzuki cut straight to the chase. Hayao Miyazaki looked up, brows furrowed, clearly not seeing Suzuki's point. Pushing his concern further, Suzuki added,
"If Satsuki is this perfect as a child, she's bound to go wrong when she grows up."
The room grew tense, a heavy silence enveloping it. Suzuki immediately realized that he might have hit a nerve. Miyazaki slowly removed his glasses, fingers trembling just a touch, and began methodically cleaning them. Each swipe seemed laden with emotion. Finally, after what seemed like an eternity, Miyazaki's voice filled the room, softer than Suzuki expected.
"No. There are children like that. At least, there was one."
Suzuki could sense the personal undertone.
"I might have been hasty. But what do you mean, Miya-san?"
Miyazaki met his gaze, a hint of vulnerability in his eyes.
"I was one of them. I was born in Tokyo, Japan in January 1941. The second of four brothers. While many families suffered deeply due to the war, my family surprisingly benefited from it. My father, Katsuji Miyazaki, was at the helm of Miyazaki Airplane, a company that produced rudders for fighter planes during World War II. Thanks to the business, we maintained a level of affluence even as Tokyo faced devastation. To keep us safe, my father had made the decision to move us north to Utsunomiya, a military stronghold that eventually drew the attention of the Allied forces. From that time, one particular memory remains etched in my mind. The evening sky unfurled shades of deep pinks and oranges, enveloping everything in a surreal glow.
Such a hue isn't typical during dusk. It's often caused by particles in the air. Dust, soot, ash. Lost in this captivating spectacle, my brothers and I. Suddenly, our uncle rushed towards us, his face tense and voice urgent. "Get in the truck, now!" he insisted, pushing us into one of the company vehicles. Starting the truck, I stared out the window. War had not only metaphorically set our world on fire, but now, it was literally engulfed in flames.
"It's burning!"
I shouted, struggling to be heard above the fire's roar. Our uncle quickly threw a thick blanket over us, but the heat was unbearable, piercing through the cloth. Each breath was heavy with smoke and fear. The city, my home, was disintegrating, a heartbreaking juxtaposition to the calm sunset earlier.
"Let us in, please!"
A woman's voice echoed with panic. Peering out, I noticed a little girl clutched to her, mirroring my mother's protective embrace.
"Let us in, please! Please, let us in!"
Was there an argument? Some commotion? I couldn't discern. But soon after, the truck moved once more.
Suzuki hadn't known this, but to Miyazaki, the memory of that woman's voice haunted him. It was a moment he replayed often in his mind. Had he told his parents to help, could he have saved them? Many fans believe this core memory would translate to the action-oriented stories and cast that Miyazaki often creates, perhaps in an effort to rewrite the narrative. And while Satsuki, the lead in My Neighbor Totoro, also leans towards action rather than inaction, the character held an even deeper personal significance for Miyazaki.
After the war, the real tragedy struck the Miyazakis. Yoshiko Miyazaki, their mother, battled spinal tuberculosis, confining her to bed for 8 years. Before her illness, young Miyazaki remembered her as a strict intellectual rebel. From her, he internalized the understanding that women are just as capable as men, if not more. Forced to step up, Hayao Miyazaki took on the household duties and matured quickly in the face of his mother's decline. Thankfully, his mother would recover, but not without causing sufficient trauma in the young Miyazaki's life. Satsuki had almost felt like a semi-autobiographical reflection, which was why Miyazaki became defensive.
Days after their chat, Miyazaki summoned Suzuki once more. This time, he showcased a scene where the young protagonist broke down, terrified her mother might die. The raw emotion, the tangible fear, was all there. While Suzuki pored over the storyboards, Miyazaki, a hint of anxiety in his voice, asked,
"So now, she's not going to turn out bad, right?"
It took him a moment before realizing what this meant.
"No,"
Suzuki replied.
"No, she won't."
In the future, Miyazaki's constant obsession with imperfect yet resilient women will appear time and time again. From the iron forge workers in Princess Mononoke to the courageous young lead in Spirited Away. In fact, of the 11 Studio Ghibli films directed by Miyazaki, 8 feature a leading female protagonist.
Both directors put their souls into the films, while a talented team brought their emotions to life. The double feature Grave of the Fireflies and My Neighbor Totoro was in full swing. The production faced periodic challenges, from trying new production styles on a tight schedule to adding an extra hour of screen time across both films. Like with Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, both films had to endure major cuts towards the end.
By the end of spring 1988, the films hit the theaters, earning rave reviews and selling nearly a million tickets. This success reaffirmed the wide appeal of animated films. Studio Ghibli's popularity soared, but internally, things looked grim. Despite exceeding expectations, none of the first three films managed to cover production costs with box office sales alone. The commercial team had to rely on secondary rights and distribution, selling the films to more channels just to stay afloat.
A concerning trend had also emerged. Since Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, each new film saw a decline in box office sales. As the three leaders, Suzuki, Miyazaki, and Takahata, observed the pattern, they decided to get back to basics and focus on producing their next film, Kiki's Delivery Service, with integrity. They firmly believed that if they stayed true to their art, the audience would follow. That belief held strong until Suzuki crossed paths with an old friend, a producer from the animation studio, Toei.
Suzuki sat down at a quiet cafe, stirring his coffee absentmindedly as he waited. Soon, a familiar face approached.
Suzuki-san.
The producer greeted warmly.
It's been too long.
Suzuki nodded in agreement.
It has. Thank you for coming.
The Toei producer took a sip of his tea, clearing his throat before speaking.
Let's get to business, Suzuki-san. We at Toei have decided to distribute Kiki's Delivery Service. Yamato Onyu's backing did weigh in on our decision.
Suzuki raised an eyebrow, curious.
I appreciate the support, but why do I sense there's a but coming?
His friend sighed, looking a touch hesitant.
The industry talks, Suzuki. Rumor has it that Kiki might be the studio's last. It would be a significant end to his era.
Suzuki, a bit taken aback, replied.
Who's spreading that notion?
The producer shrugged.
Whispers here and there. But look at the trend, Suzuki. Since Nausicaä, each film's box office draw has been shrinking.
We've always been about the heart of the film, not the numbers.
The producer leaned in.
I understand. I'm glad you think that way. It's admirable.
By the meeting's end, Suzuki had stormed out, anger in his eyes, but with a renewed determination within. Merely producing a Studio Ghibli film wouldn't suffice anymore. He aimed to maximize promotions and drive its commercial success. From that day on, many said that Studio Ghibli had transformed into a business.
Kiki's Delivery Service features Kiki, a young witch, and her venture into running her own delivery service. The original book is a series of small, episodic stories, showcasing various people and events Kiki encounters on her delivery routes. Interestingly, Kiki doesn't face any significant bad or dramatic events, which doesn't provide the necessary tension for the film adaptation.
Because of this, Miyazaki decided to take a creative leap and reshape the story into a coming-of-age story instead. He commented,
As movies always create a more realistic feeling, Kiki will suffer stronger setbacks and loneliness than in the original.
Many found these alterations logical and fitting for the film's context. However, Miss Kadono, the original book's author, was not one of them. She was so displeased with these changes that the project nearly came to a halt during the screenplay phase. In response, Miyazaki and Suzuki, the producers at Studio Ghibli, made it their mission to win Miss Kadono over. They visited her home, invited her to the studio, and after much discussion, finally obtained her approval for the film. For Suzuki, the initial hurdles in producing Kiki's Delivery Service underscored the vital need for its success. More than just a statement to the industry, it was about preserving the trust of the creators. Any misstep might tarnish Studio Ghibli's reputation, hindering future adaptations of literary works.
By April 1st, 1988, Suzuki had tapped into all his contacts, particularly leveraging his ties with Nippon TV, or NTV, one of Japan's major TV networks. But it wasn't straightforward. Only the younger directors at NTV were acquainted with Miyazaki. Most of the advertising clout was held by senior directors, who needed persuasion. Suzuki, collaborating with an NTV representative, initially pitched ads that wouldn't interfere with current shows. This approach was well received, especially since existing programs remained undisturbed.
They began with a daily live morning show, featuring a young girl dressed as Kiki, the film's protagonist, standing in the backdrop while broadcasters were on air. Additionally, they proposed airing Miyazaki's previous films on TV, a tantalizing offer for the network. As the momentum built, they introduced special segments interviewing young girls, mirroring Kiki in age and appearance. Suzuki even included his own daughter in one episode. As a result, young viewers felt seen and heard, leading to a buzz around the show.
In the midst of this, the marketing team struck upon the idea of a behind-the-scenes documentary about the film's creation, which struck a chord with Japanese audiences. While a making-of video before the main feature might seem odd to many, in Japan, it made perfect sense. The food and beverage industry in Japan understands this best, where every food is often touted in great detail. In Japan's food and beverage industry, every detail of a product is proudly shared. Customers learn about everything, from the rice's region and elevation to the countless hours invested in fermenting a sauce. This meticulous backstory fosters a sense of gratitude even before consumption.
Itadakimasu!
So, when this strategy was applied to other realms, the outcome was predictably positive. Fans began to deeply appreciate the painstaking efforts behind Studio Ghibli's films. As the premiere neared, Suzuki pressed Miyazaki to embark on a promotional tour, covering cities like Nagoya, Osaka, and Fukuoka. While building the anticipation for Kiki's Delivery Service, they also engaged corporate partners for co-promotion.
One notable ally was Yamato Unyu, a logistics firm. They rolled out an ad with Kiki and her cat, Gigi, lost in thought by a window. Curiously, most of the ad's text didn't even talk about the film. Instead, only at the end was there a small mention.
Yamato Unyu sponsors Kiki's Delivery Service.
The main ad text praised the company's nurturing approach towards each delivery, likening it to a mother cat caring for her kittens. This tied to their logo, a black cat with a kitten, and subtly recalled Gigi from the film.
The clear message? Care, warmth, dedication, seamlessly weaving the film's essence with the logistics company's ethos. This clever blending would set the gold standard for future collaborations, ensuring characters and corporations melded so tightly that audiences linked the film's spirit with the company's brand.
By the close of 1988, production was intense. A bold decision was made to add a gripping scene. Hordes of onlookers watching Kiki, spoiler ahead, rescue a man on TV. Given it was all hand-animated, depicting a moving crowd demanded an avalanche of drawings. This translated to more effort and hours.
Concurrently, Joe Hisaishi, the studio's primary composer, was swamped with other commitments. And, not to mention, in classic Studio Ghibli fashion, the film's runtime unexpectedly stretched from a succinct 60 to a hefty 100 minutes. Staring at the challenge ahead, Suzuki probably realized what they needed wasn't more planning.
Maybe what they needed was a miracle. That's coming in the next episode. From 1UP Media, this is Empires, episode 4 of a 5-part series, Before Spirited. Next on Empires, we'll chart Studio Ghibli's path with the release of Kiki's Delivery Service. Then, we'll delve into the studio's monumental film, Princess Mononoke, which made them a national sensation. Follow us so you won't miss out on episode 5 of our 5-part series, Hatred and Cursed. It's a 1UP Media original, produced and written by Guang Jin. Edited by Alex. Audio experience by Ethan Sam. Additional engineering by Ashley from 1UP Media. And narrated by Luis Cruz and Claire Bernal. International research by Sonia, Kuyet, and Jiamin from 1UP Media. A quick word on our reenactments and dramatizations. While we can't know exactly what they say, think, or feel at the moment, it is all based on research. Thank you for listening.